Tyler Baldwin grumbled in class. I fall asleep every time I start to read it. What's that called? Narcolepsy? This complaint evinced a chorus of agreement, but Molly was silent, and Mrs. Tate, on alert, no doubt, for the slightest spark in the damp woodpile of her class, noticed. So, what do you think, Molly? Molly shrugged, not wanting to appear overeager. I like the book. What do you like about it? I don't know. I just like it. What's your favorite part? Feeling the eyes of the class on her, Molly shrank a little in her chair. I don't know. It's just a boring romance novel, Tyler said. No, it isn't, she blurted. Why not? Mrs. Tate pressed. Because, she thought for a moment. Jane's kind of an outlaw. She's passionate and determined and says exactly what she thinks. Where do you get that? Because I'm definitely not feeling it, Tyler said. Okay, well, like this line, Molly said. Riffling through the book, she found the scene she was thinking of. I assured him I was naturally hard, very flinty, and that he would often find me so, and that, moreover, I was determined to show him diverse rugged points in my character. He should know fully what sort of a bargain he had made, while there was yet time to rescind it. Mrs. Tate raised her eyebrows and smiled. Sounds like someone I know. Now, sitting alone in a red wingback chair, waiting for Vivian to come down, Molly takes out Anne of Green Gables. She opens to the first page. Mrs. Rachel Lynde lived just where the Avonlea main road dipped down into a little hollow, fringed with alders and ladies' eardrops and traversed by a brook that had its source away back in the woods of the old Cuthbert place. It's clearly a book intended for young girls, and at first Molly isn't sure she can relate. But as she reads, she finds herself caught up in the story. The sun moves higher in the sky. She has to tilt the book out of the glare and then, after several minutes, switch to the other wing back so she doesn't have to squint. After an hour or so, she hears the door to the hall open, and she looks up. Vivian comes into the room, glances around, focuses on Molly, and smiles, seemingly unsurprised to see her. "Bright and early," she says. "I like your enthusiasm. Maybe I'll let you empty out a box today. Or two, if you're lucky." Albans, Minnesota, 1929. On Monday morning, I get up early and wash my face in the kitchen sink before Mr. and Mrs. Byrne are up, then braid my hair carefully and attach two ribbons I found in the scrap pile in the sewing room. I put on my cleanest dress and the pinafore, which I hung on a branch by the side of the house to dry after we did the washing on Sunday. At breakfast, lumpy oats with no sugar. When I ask how to get to school and what time I'm expected to be there, Mrs. Byrne looks at her husband and then back at me. She pulls her dark paisley scarf tight around her shoulders. "Dorothy, Mr. Byrne and I feel that you are not ready for school." The oats taste like congealed animal fat in my mouth. I look at Mr. Byrne, who is bending to tie his shoelaces. His frizzy curls flop over his forehead, hiding his face. "What do you mean?" I ask. "The children's aid?" Mrs. Byrne clasps her hands together and gives me a tight-lipped smile. "You are no longer a ward of the Children's Aid Society, are you? We are the ones to determine what's best for you now." My heart skips. "But I'm supposed to go." "We'll see how you progress over the next few weeks, but for now we think it best for you to take some time to adjust to your new home." "I am adjusted," I say, warmth rising to my cheeks. "I've done everything you've asked of me. If you're concerned, I won't have time to do the sewing." Mrs. Byrne fixes me with a steady eye, and my voice falters. "School has been in session for more than a month," she says. "You are impossibly behind, with no chance of catching up this year. And Lord knows what your schooling was like in the slum." My skin prickles. Even Mr. Byrne is startled by this.
"Now, now, Lois," he says under his breath.
"I wasn't in a slum," I choke out the word. And then, because she hasn't asked, because neither of them has asked, I add, "I was in the fourth grade. My teacher was Miss Ulrig. I was in the chorus and we performed an operetta, Polished Pebbles." They both look at me. "I like school," I say. Mrs. Byrne gets up and starts to stack our dishes. She takes my plate even though I haven't finished my toast. Her actions are jerky and the silverware clanks against the china. She runs water in the sink and dumps the plates and utensils into it with a loud clatter. Then she turns around, wiping her hands on her apron. You, insolent girl. I don't want to hear another word. We are the ones who decide what's best for you. Is that clear? And that's the end of it. The subject of school doesn't come up again. Several times a day, Mrs. Byrne materializes in the sewing room like a phantom, but she never picks up a needle. Her duties, as far as I can see, consist of keeping track of orders, handing out assignments to Fanny, who then doles them out to us, and collecting the finished garments. She asks Fanny for progress reports, all the while scanning the room to be sure the rest of us are hard at work. I am full of questions for the Burns that I'm afraid to ask. What is Mr. Burns's business exactly? What does he do with the clothes the women make? I could say we make, but the work I do, basting and hemming, is like peeling potatoes and calling yourself a cook. Where does Mrs. Byrne go all day, and what does she do with her time? I can hear her upstairs now and then, but it's impossible to know what she's up to. Mrs. Byrne has many rules. She scolds me in front of the other girls for minor infractions and mistakes, not folding my bed linen as tightly as I should have, or leaving the door to the kitchen ajar. All doors in the house are supposed to be shut at all times, unless you're entering or leaving. The way the house is closed off, the door to the sewing room, the doors to the kitchen and dining room, even the door at the top of the stairs, makes it a forbidding and mysterious place. At night, on my pallet in that dark hall at the foot of the stairs, rubbing my feet together for warmth, I am frightened. I've never been alone like this. Even at the Children's Aid Society, in my iron bed on the ward, I was surrounded by other girls. I'm not allowed to help in the kitchen. I think Mrs. Byrne is afraid I might steal food. And indeed, like Fanny, I have taken to slipping a slice of bread or an apple into my pocket. The food Mrs. Byrne makes is bland and unappealing. Soft grey peas from a can, starchy boiled potatoes, watery stews, and there's never enough of it. I can't tell if Mr. Byrne really doesn't notice how dreadful the food is, or whether he doesn't care, or if his mind is simply elsewhere. When Mrs. Byrne isn't around, Mr. Byrne is friendly. He likes to talk with me about Ireland. His own family, he tells me, is from Sallybrook, near the East Coast. His uncle and cousins were Republicans in the War of Independence. They fought with Michael Collins and were there at the Four Courts building in Dublin in April of 1922, when the Brits stormed the building and killed the insurgents. And they were there when Collins was assassinated a few months later, near Cork. Collins was the greatest hero Ireland ever had, don't you know? Yes, I nod. I know. But I'm skeptical his cousins were there. My da used to say, every Irishman you meet in America swears to have a relative who fought alongside Michael Collins. My da loved Michael Collins. He sang all the revolutionary songs, usually loudly and out of tune, until Mam would tell him to be quiet, that the babies were sleeping. He told me lots of dramatic stories. About the Kilmainham jail in Dublin, for instance, where one of the leaders of the 1916 uprising, Joseph Plunkett, married his sweetheart Grace Gifford in the tiny chapel just hours before being executed by firing squad. 15 were executed in all that day. Even James Connolly, who was too ill to stand. So they strapped him to a chair and carried him out into the courtyard and riddled his body with bullets. Riddled his body with bullets. My da talked like that. Mam was always shushing him, but he waved her off. It's important they know this, he said. It's their history. We might be over here now, but by God, our people are over there. Mam had her reasons for wanting to forget. It was the 1922 treaty, leading to the formation of the Free State, that pushed us out of Kinvara, she said. The Crown forces, determined to crush the rebels, raided towns in County Galway and blew up railway lines. The economy was in ruins. Little work was to be had. My da couldn't find a job. Well, it was that, she said, and the drink. You could be my daughter, you know, Mr. Byrne tells me. Your name? Dorothy. We always said we'd give to our own child someday. But alas, it didn't come to pass. And here you are, red hair and all. I keep forgetting to answer to Dorothy. But in a way, I'm glad to have a new identity. It makes it easier to let go of so much else. I'm not the same Niamh who left her gram and aunties and uncles in Kinvara and came across the ocean on the Agnes Pauline, who lived with her family on Elizabeth Street. No, I am Dorothy now. Dorothy, we need to talk,
Mrs. Byrne says at dinner one evening. I glance at Mr. Byrne, who is studiously buttering a baked potato. Mary says that you are not, how should I put this, a particularly quick learner. She says that you seem resistant? Defiant, she's not sure which. It's not true. Mrs. Byrne's eyes blaze. Listen closely. If it were up to me, I would contact the committee immediately and return you for a replacement. But Mr. Byrne convinced me to give you a second chance. However, if I hear one more complaint about your behavior or comportment, you will be returned. She pauses and takes a sip of water. I am tempted to attribute this behavior to your Irish blood. Yes, it is true that Mr. Byrne is Irish.
Indeed.
That's why we gave you a chance at all. But I would also point out that Mr. Byrne did not, as he might have, marry an Irish girl. For good reason. The next day, Mrs. Byrne comes into the sewing room and says she needs me to go on an errand into the center of town, a mile's walk.
It's not complicated, she says testily when I ask for directions. Weren't you paying attention when we drove you here?
I can go with her this first time, ma'am, Fanny says. Mrs. Byrne does not look happy about this.
Don't you have work to do, Fanny?
I just finished this pile, Fanny says, placing a veined hand on a stack of ladies' skirts. All hemmed and ironed. My fingers are sore.
All right, then. This once, Mrs. Byrne says.
We walk slowly, on account of Fanny's hip, through the Burns' neighborhood of small houses on cramped lots. At the corner of Elm Street, we turn left onto Center and cross Maple, Birch, and Spruce before turning right onto Main. Most of the houses seem fairly new and are variations of the same few designs. They're painted different colors, landscaped neatly with shrubs and bushes. Some front walkways go straight to the door, and others meander in a curvy path. As we get closer to town, we pass multi-family dwellings and some outlying businesses. A gas station, a corner shop, a nursery stocked with flowers the colors of autumn leaves, rust and gold and crimson.
I can't imagine why you didn't memorize this route on the drive home, Fanny says.
My girl, you are slow. I look at her sideways and she gives me a sly smile. The general store on Main Street is dimly lit and very warm. It takes a moment for my eyes to adjust. When I look up, I see cured hams hanging from the ceiling and shelves of dry goods. Fanny and I pick up several packs of sewing needles, some patterned papers, and a bolt of cheesecloth, and after she pays, Fanny takes a penny from the change she gets and slides it toward me across the counter. Get yourself a stick of candy for the walk back. The jars of hard candy sticks lined up on a shelf hold dazzling combinations of colors and flavors. After deliberating for a long moment, I choose a swirl of pink watermelon and green apple. I unwrap my candy stick and offer to break off a piece, but Fanny refuses it.
I don't have a sweet tooth anymore.
I didn't know you could outgrow that.
It's for you, she says.
On the way back, we walk slowly. Neither of us, I think, is eager to get there. The hard, grooved candy stick is both sweet and sour, a jolt of flavor so intense I almost swoon. I suck it so that it tapers to a point, savoring each taste.
You'll have to get rid of that before we reach the house, Fanny says. She doesn't need to explain.
Why does Mary hate me? I ask when we're nearly there.
Psh, she doesn't hate you, child. She's scared.
Of what?
What do you think?
I don't know. Why would Mary be scared of me?
She's sure you're going to take her job, Fanny says. Mrs. Byrne holds her money tight in her fist. Why would she pay Mary to do the work you can be trained to do for nothing?
I try not to betray any emotion, but Fanny's words sting. That's why they picked me. She smiles kindly.
You must know that already. Any girl who can hold a needle and thread would have sufficed. Free labor is free labor.
As we climb the steps to the house, she says,
You can't blame Mary for being afraid.
From then on, instead of worrying about Mary, I concentrate on the work. I focus on making my stitches identically sized and spaced. I carefully iron each garment until it's smooth and crisp. Each piece of clothing that moves from my basket to Mary's, or one of the other women's, gives me a feeling of accomplishment. But my relationship with her doesn't improve. If anything, as my own work gets better, she becomes harsher and more exacting. I place a basted skirt in my basket, and Mary snatches it.
looks at it closely, rips the stitches out, and tosses it at me again. The leaves turn, from rose-tinged to candy-apple red to a dull brown, and I walk to the outhouse on a spongy, sweet-smelling carpet. One day, Mrs. Byrne looks me up and down and asks if I have any other clothes. I've been alternating between the two dresses I came with, one blue and white checked and one gingham. No, I say. Well then, she says, you will make yourself some. Later that afternoon, she drives me to town, one foot hesitantly on the gas pedal and the other, at erratic intervals, on the brake. Proceeding forward in a jerky fashion, we end up eventually in front of the general store. You may choose 3 different fabrics, she says. Let's see, 3 yards each? I nod. The cloth must be sturdy and inexpensive. That's the only kind that makes sense for it. She pauses. A 9-year-old girl. Mrs. Byrne leads me over to a section filled with bolts of fabric, directing me to the shelf with the cheaper ones. I choose a blue and gray checked cotton, a delicate green print, and a pink paisley. Mrs. Byrne nods at the first 2 choices and grimaces at the 3rd. Mercy, not with red hair. She pulls out a bolt of blue chambray. A modest bodice is what I'm thinking, with a minimum of frill, simple and plain. A gathered skirt. You can wear that pinafore on top when you're working. Do you have more than 1 pinafore? When I shake my head, she says, we have plenty of ticking fabric in the sewing room. You can make it from that. Do you have a coat? Or a sweater? The nuns gave me a coat, but it's too small. After the fabric is measured, cut, wrapped in brown paper, and tied with twine, I follow Mrs. Byrne down the street to a women's clothes shop. She heads straight for the sale rack at the back and finds a mustard-colored wool coat, several sizes too big for me, with shiny black buttons. When I put it on, she frowns. Well, it's a good deal, she says, and there's no sense in getting something you'll outgrow in a month. I think it's fine. I hate the coat. It's not even very warm, but I'm afraid to object. Luckily, there's a large selection of sweaters on clearance, and I find a navy blue cable knit and an off-white V-neck in my size. Mrs. Byrne adds a bulky, too large corduroy skirt that's 70% off. That evening at dinner, I wear my new white sweater and skirt. What's that thing around your neck? Mrs. Byrne says, and I realize that she is talking about my necklace, which is usually hidden by my high-necked dresses. She leans closer to look. An Irish cross? I say. It's very odd-looking. What are those hands? And why does the heart have a crown? She sits back in her chair. That looks sacrilegious to me. I tell her the story of how my gram was given this necklace for her first communion and passed it down to me before I came to America. The hands clasped together symbolize friendship. The heart is love, and the crown stands for loyalty, I explain. She sniffs, refolds the napkin in her lap. I still think it's odd. I have half a mind to make you take it off. Come now, Lois, Mr. Byrne says. It's a trinket from home. No harm to it. Perhaps it's time to put away those old country things. It's not bothering anyone, is it? I glance over at him, surprised that he's sticking up for me. He winks at me, as if it's a game. It's bothering me, she says. There's no reason this girl needs to tell the world far and wide that she's a Catholic. Mr. Byrne laughs. Look at her hair. There's no denying she's Irish, is there? So unbecoming in a girl, Mrs. Byrne says under her breath. Later, Mr. Byrne tells me that his wife doesn't like Catholics in general, even though she married one. It helps that he never goes to church. Works out well for the both of us, he says. Albans, Minnesota, 1929 to 1930. When Mrs. Byrne appears in the sewing room one Tuesday afternoon at the end of October, it's clear that something is wrong. She looks haggard and stricken. Her cropped dark bob, usually in tight waves against her head, is sticking out all over. Bernice jumps up, but Mrs. Byrne waves her away. Girls, she says, holding her hand to her throat. Girls! I need to tell you something. The stock market crashed today. It's in free fall. And many lives are... She stops to catch her breath. Ma'am, do you want to sit down? Bernice says. Mrs. Byrne ignores her. People lost everything. she mutters, gripping the back of Mary's chair. Her eyes roam the room as if she is looking for something to focus on. If we can't feed ourselves, we can hardly afford to employ you now, can we? Her eyes fill with tears and she backs out of the room, shaking her head. We hear the front door open and Mrs. Byrne clatter down the steps. Bernice tells us all to get back to work, but Joan, one of the women at the Singers, stands up abruptly. I have to get home to my husband. I have to know what's going on. What use is it to keep working if we won't be paid? Leave if you must, Fanny says. Joan is the only one who leaves, but the rest of us are jittery throughout the afternoon. It's hard to sew when your hands are shaking. It's hard to tell exactly what's going on, but as the weeks pass, we begin to catch glimmers. Mr. Byrne apparently invested quite a bit in the stock market, and the money is gone. The demand for new garments has slowed, and people have taken to mending their own clothes. It's one place they can easily cut corners. Mrs. Byrne is even more scattered and absent. We've stopped eating dinner together. She takes her food upstairs, leaving a desiccated chicken leg or a bowl of cold brisket and a chunk of brown gelatinous fat on the counter, with strict instructions that I wash my dish when I'm done. Thanksgiving is like any other day. I never celebrated it with my Irish family, so it doesn't bother me, but the girls mutter under their breath all day long. It's not Christian. It's not American to keep them from their families. Maybe because the alternative is so bleak, I've grown to like the sewing room. I look forward to seeing the women every day. Kind Fanny, simple-minded Bernice, and quiet Sally and Joan. All except Mary, who can't seem to forgive me for being alive. And I like the work. My fingers are getting strong and quick. A piece that used to take an hour or more, I can do in minutes. I used to be afraid of new stitches and techniques, but now welcome each new challenge. Pencil-sharp pleats, sequins, delicate lace. The others can see that I'm improving, and they've started giving me more to do. Without ever saying it directly, Fanny has taken over Mary's job of supervising my work. Be careful, dear, she says, running a light finger over my stitches. Take the time to make them small and even. Remember, somebody will wear this, probably over and over until it's worn through. A lady wants to feel pretty, no matter how much money she has. Ever since I arrived in Minnesota, people have been warning me about the extreme cold that's on the way. I am beginning to feel it. Kinvara's rain-soaked much of the year, and Irish winters are cold and wet. New York is gray and slushy and miserable for months. But neither place compares to this. Already we've had two big snowstorms. As the weather gets colder, my fingers are so stiff when I'm sewing that I have to stop and rub them so I can keep going. I notice that the other women are wearing fingerless gloves, and when I ask where they came from, they tell me they made them themselves. I don't know how to knit. My mom never taught me, but I know I need to get a pair of gloves for my stiff, cold hands. Several days before Christmas, Mrs. Byrne announces that Christmas Day, Wednesday, will be an unpaid holiday. She and Mr. Byrne will be gone for the day, visiting relatives out of town. She doesn't ask me to come along. At the end of our workday on Christmas Eve, Fanny slips me a small brown-wrapped parcel. Open this later, she whispers. Tell them you brought it from home. I put the packet in my pocket and wade through knee-deep snow to the privy, where I open it in the semi-darkness, wind slicing through the cracks in the walls and the slit in the door. It's a pair of fingerless gloves knit from a dense navy blue yarn, and a thick pair of brown wool mittens. When I put on the mittens, I find that Fanny lined them with heavy wool and reinforced the top of the thumb and other fingers with extra padding. As with Dutchie and Carmine on the train, this little cluster of women has become a kind of family to me. Like an abandoned foal that nestles against cows in the barnyard, maybe I just need to feel the warmth of belonging. And if I'm not going to find that with the Byrnes, I will find it, however partial and illusory, with the women in the sewing room. By January, I am losing so much weight that my new dresses, the ones I made myself, swim on my hips. Mr. Byrne comes and goes at odd hours, and I barely see him. We have less and less work. Fanny is teaching me how to knit, and sometimes the other girls bring in work of their own so they won't go crazy with idleness. The heat is turned off as soon as the workers leave at 5. The lights go off at 7. I spend nights on my pallet, wide awake and shivering in the dark, listening to the howling of the seemingly endless storms that rage outside. I wonder about Dutchie. If he's sleeping in a barn with animals, eating only pig slops. I hope he's warm. One day, in early February, Mrs. Byrne enters the sewing room silently and unexpectedly. She seems to have stopped grooming. She's worn the same dress all week, and her bodice is soiled. Her hair is lank and greasy, and she has a sore on her lip. She asks the singer girl, Sally, to step out into the hall, and several minutes later, Sally returns to the room with red-rimmed eyes. She picks up her belongings in silence. A few weeks later, Mrs. Byrne comes for Bernice. They go out into the hall, and then Bernice returns and gathers her things. After that, it's just Fanny and Mary and me. It's a windy afternoon in late March when Mrs. Byrne slips into the room and asks for Mary. I feel sorry for Mary then, despite her meanness, despite everything. Slowly, she picks up her belongings, puts on her hat and coat. She looks at Fanny and me and nods, and we nod back. God bless you, child, Fanny says. When Mary and Mrs. Byrne leave the room, Fanny and I watch the door. Straining to hear the indistinct murmuring in the hall, Fanny says, Lordy, I'm too old for this. A week later, the doorbell rings. Fanny and I look at each other. This is strange. The doorbell never rings. We hear Mrs. Byrne rustle down the stairs, undo the heavy locks, open the squeaky door. We hear her talking to a man in the hall. The door to the sewing room opens, and I jump a little. In comes a heavy-set man in a black felt hat and a grey suit. He has a black moustache and jowls like a basset hound.
"This the girl?"
he asks, pointing a sausagey finger at me. Mrs. Byrne nods. The man takes off his hat and sets it on a small table by the door. Then he pulls a pair of eyeglasses out of the breast pocket of his overcoat and puts them on, perched partway down his bulbous nose. He takes a piece of folded paper out of another pocket and opens it with one hand.
"Let's see. Nem power."
He pronounces it Nem. Peering over his glasses at Mrs. Byrne, he says,
"You changed her name to Dorothy?"
"We thought the girl should have an American name." Mrs. Byrne makes a strangled sound that I interpret as a laugh. "Not legally, of course," she adds.
"And you did not change her surname?"
"Of course not."
"You weren't considering adoption?"
"Mercy, no." He looks at me over his glasses, then back at the paper. The clock ticks loudly above the mantelpiece. The man folds the paper and puts it back in his pocket.
"Dorothy, I am Mr. Sorensen. I am a local agent of the Children's Aid Society, and as such, I oversee the placement of homeless train riders. Oftentimes, the placements work out as they should, and everyone is content. But now and then, unfortunately..."
He takes his glasses off and slips them back into his breast pocket.
"Things don't work out."
He looks at Mrs. Byrne. She has, I notice, a jagged run in her beige stockings, and her eye makeup is smeared.
"And we need to procure new accommodations."
He clears his throat.
"Do you understand what I'm saying?"
I nod, though I'm not sure I do.
"Good. There's a couple. In Hemmingford. Well, on a farm outside of that town, actually. Who've requested a girl about your age. A mother, father, and four children. Wilma and Gerald Groat."
I turn to Mrs. Byrne. She is gazing off somewhere in the middle distance. Though she's never been particularly kind to me, her willingness to abandon me comes as a shock. "You don't want me anymore?" Mr. Sorensen looks back and forth between us.
"It's a complicated situation."
As we're talking, Mrs. Byrne drifts over to the window. She pulls aside the lace curtain and gazes out at the street, at the skim milk sky.
"I'm sure you have heard this is a difficult time,"
Mr. Sorensen continues.
"Not only for the Byrnes, but for a lot of people. And, well, their business has been affected."
With a sudden movement, Mrs. Byrne drops the curtain and wheels around. "She eats too much!" she cries. "I have to padlock the refrigerator. It's never enough!" She puts her palms over her eyes and runs past us, out into the hallway and up the stairs, where she slams the door at the top. We are silent for a moment. Then Fanny says, "That woman ought to be ashamed. The girl is skin and bones," she adds. "They never even sent her to school." Mr. Sorensen clears his throat.
Well,
he says,
perhaps this will be for the best, for all concerned.
He fixes on me again.
The Groats are good country people, from what I hear.
Four children, I say. Why do they want another?
As I understand it, and I could be wrong, I haven't had the pleasure to meet them yet. This is all hearsay, you understand. But what I have gleaned is that Mrs. Groat is once again with child, and she is looking for a mother's helper.
I ponder this. I think of Carmine, of Maisie, of the twins, sitting at our rickety table on Elizabeth Street, waiting patiently for their apple mash. I imagine a white farmhouse with black shutters, a red barn in the back, a post and rail fence, chickens in a coop. Anything has to be better than a padlocked refrigerator and a pallet in the hall. When do they want me?
I'm taking you there now.
Mr. Sorensen says he'll give me a few minutes to collect my things, and goes out to his car. In the hall, I pull my brown suitcase from the back of the closet. Fanny stands in the door of the sewing room and watches me pack. I fold up the three dresses I made, one of which, the blue chambray, I haven't finished, plus my other dress from the children's aid. I add the two new sweaters and the corduroy skirt, and the mittens and gloves from Fanny. I'd just as soon leave the ugly mustard coat behind, but Fanny says I'll regret it if I do, that it's even colder out there on those farms than it is here in town. When I'm done, we go back in the sewing room, and Fanny finds a small pair of scissors, two spools of thread, black and white, a pin cushion and pins, and a cellophane packet of needles. She adds a cardboard flat of opalescent buttons for my unfinished dress. Then she wraps it all in cheesecloth for me to tuck in the top of my suitcase. "Won't you get in trouble for giving me these?" I ask her. "Pish," she says. "I don't even care." I do not say goodbye to the Burns. Who knows where Mr. Byrne is, and Mrs. Byrne doesn't come downstairs. But Fanny gives me a long hug. She holds my face in her small, cold hands. "You are a good girl, Neve," she says. "Don't let anybody tell you different." Mr. Sorensen's vehicle, parked in the driveway behind the Model A, is a dark green Chrysler truck. He opens the passenger door for me, then goes around to the other side. The interior smells of tobacco and apples. He backs out of the driveway and points the car to the left, away from town and toward a direction I've never been. We follow Elm Street until it ends, then turn right down another quiet street, where the houses are set back farther from the sidewalks, until we come to an intersection and turn onto a long, flat road with fields on both sides. I gaze out at the fields, a dull patchwork. Brown cows huddle together, lifting their necks to watch the noisy truck as it passes. Horses graze. Pieces of farm equipment in the distance look like abandoned toys. The horizon line, flat and low, is straight ahead, and the sky looks like dishwater. Blackbirds pierce the sky like inverse stars. I feel almost sorry for Mr. Sorensen on our drive. I can tell this weighs on him. It's probably not what he thought he was signing up for when he agreed to be an agent for the Children's Aid Society. He keeps asking if I'm comfortable, if the heat is too low or too high. When he learns I know almost nothing about Minnesota, he tells me all about it. How it became a state just over 70 years ago and is now the 12th largest in the United States. How its name comes from a Dakota Indian word for cloudy water. How it contains thousands of lakes filled with fish of all kinds. Walleye, for one thing, catfish, largemouth bass, rainbow trout, perch, and pike. The Mississippi River starts in Minnesota, did I know that? And these fields, he waves his fingers toward the window, they feed the whole country. Let's see, there's grain, the biggest export. A thrasher goes from farm to farm, and neighbors get together to bundle the shocks. There's sugar beets, and sweet corn, and green peas. And those low buildings way over there? Turkey farms. Minnesota is the biggest producer of turkeys in the country. There'd be no Thanksgiving without Minnesota, that's for darn sure. And don't get me started on hunting. We've got pheasants, quail, grouse, white-tailed deer, you name it. It's a hunter's paradise. I listen to Mr. Sorensen and nod politely as he talks. But it's hard to concentrate. I feel myself retreating to someplace deep inside. It is a pitiful kind of childhood. To know that no one loves you or is taking care of you. To always be on the outside looking in. I feel a decade older than my years. I know too much. I have seen people at their worst, at their most desperate and selfish, and this knowledge makes me wary. So I am learning to pretend, to smile and nod, to display empathy I do not feel. I am learning to pass, to look like everyone else, even though I feel broken inside. Hemingford County, Minnesota, 1930. After about half an hour, Mr. Sorensen turns onto a narrow, unpaved road. Dirt rises around us as we drive, coating the windshield and side windows. We pass more fields and then a copse of birch tree skeletons, cross through a dilapidated covered bridge over a murky stream still sheeted with ice, turn down a bumpy dirt road bordered by pine trees. Mr. Sorensen is holding a card with what looks like directions on it. He slows the truck, pulls to a stop, looks back toward the bridge. Then he peers out the grimy windshield at the trees ahead.
"No gol darn signs," he mutters.
He puts his foot on the pedal and inches forward. Out of the side window, I point to a faded red rag tied to a stick and what appears to be a driveway overgrown with weeds.
"Must be it," he says.
Hairy branches scrape the truck on either side as we make our way down the drive. After about 50 yards, we come to a small wooden house, a shack, really, unpainted with a sagging front porch piled with junk. In the grassless section in front of the house, a baby is crawling on top of a dog with black matted fur, and a boy of about 6 is poking a stick in the dirt. His hair is so short, and he's so skinny, that he looks like a wizened old man. Despite the cold, he and the baby are barefoot. Mr. Sorensen parks the truck as far from the children as possible in the small clearing, and gets out of the truck. I get out on my side.
"Hello, boy,"
he says. The child gapes at him, not answering.
"Your mama home?"
"Who want to know?" the boy says.
Mr. Sorensen smiles.
"Did your mama tell you you're getting a new sister?"
"No."
"Well, she should be expecting us. Go on and tell her we're here."
The boy stabs at the dirt with the stick.
"She's sleeping. I'm not to bother her."
"You go on and wake her up. Maybe she forgot we were coming."
The boy traces a circle in the dirt.
"Tell her it's Mr. Sorensen from the Children's Aid Society."
He shakes his head.
"Don't want a whooping."
"She's not going to whip you, boy. She'll be glad to know I'm here."
When it's clear the boy isn't going to move, Mr. Sorensen rubs his hands together and, motioning for me to follow, makes his way gingerly up the creaking steps to the porch. I can tell he's worried about what we might find inside. I am, too. He knocks loudly on the door, and it swings open from the force of his hand. There's a hole where the doorknob is supposed to be. He steps into the gloom, ushering me in with him. The front room is nearly bare. It smells like a cave. The floor is planked with rough boards, and in places I can see clear through to the ground below. Of the three grimy windows, one has a jagged hole in the upper right corner, and one is seamed with spidery cracks. A wooden crate stands between two upholstered chairs, soiled with dirt, stuffing coming out of split seams, and a threadbare gold sofa. On the far left is a dark hallway. Straight ahead, through an open doorway, is the kitchen.
"Mrs. Grote? Hello?"
Mr. Sorensen cocks his head, but there's no response.
"I'm not going into a bedroom to find her, that's for sure,"
he mutters.
"Mrs. Grote!"
he calls, louder. We hear faint footsteps and a girl of about 3, in a dirty pink dress, emerges from the hall.
"Well, hello, little girl,"
Mr. Sorensen says, crouching down on his heels.
"Is your mama back there?"
"We sleeping."
"That's what your brother said. Is she still asleep?"
A harsh voice comes from the hallway, startling us both.
"What do you want?"
Mr. Sorensen stands up slowly. A pale woman with long brown hair steps out of the darkness. Her eyes are puffy and her lips are chapped, and her nightgown is so thin I can see the dark circles of her nipples through the cloth. The girl sidles over like a cat and puts an arm around her legs.
"I'm Chester Sorensen from the Children's Aid Society. You must be Mrs. Grote. I'm sorry to bother you, ma'am, but I was told you knew we were coming. You did request a girl, did you not?"
The woman rubs her eyes.
"What day is it?"
"Friday," April 4th, ma'am.
She coughs. Then she doubles over and coughs again, harder this time, into her fist.
Would you like to sit down?
Mr. Sorensen goes over and guides her by the elbow to a chair.
Now, is Mr. Grote home?
The woman shakes her head.
Are you expecting him soon?
She lifts her shoulders in a shrug.
What time does he get off work?
Mr. Sorensen presses.
He don't go to work no more. Lost his job at the feed store last week.
She glances around as if she's lost something. Then she says,
Come here, Mabel.
The little girl slinks over to her, watching us the whole time.
Go check and see that Gerald Jr. is okay in there.
Where's Harold?
Is that the boy outside?
Mr. Sorensen asks.
He watching the baby? I told him to.
They're both out there.
He says, and though his voice is neutral, I can tell he doesn't approve. Mrs. Grote chews her lip. She still hasn't said a word to me. She's barely looked in my direction.
I'm just so tired.
She says to no one in particular.
Well, I'm sure you are, ma'am.
It's clear Mr. Sorensen is itching to get out of here.
I'm guessing that's why you asked for this here orphan girl, Dorothy. Her papers say she has experience with children, so that should be a help to you.
She nods distractedly.
I got to sleep when they sleep, she mumbles. It's the only time I get any rest.
I'm sure it is.
Mrs. Grote covers her face with both hands. Then she pushes her stringy hair back behind her ears. She juts her chin at me.
This is the girl, huh?
Yes, ma'am. Name's Dorothy. She's here to be part of your family and be taken care of by you and help you in return.
She focuses on my face, but her eyes are flat.
What's her age?
9 years old.
I have enough kids. What I need is somebody who can help me out.
It's all part of the deal,
Mr. Sorensen says.
You feed and clothe Dorothy and make sure she gets to school, and she will earn her keep by doing chores around the house.
He pulls his glasses and the sheet of paper out of his various pockets, then puts his glasses on and tilts his head back to read it.
I see there's a school 4 miles down, and there's a ride she can catch at the post road, 3/4 mile from here.
He takes his glasses off.
It's required that Dorothy attend school, Mrs. Grote. Do you agree to abide by that?
She crosses her arms, and for a moment it looks as if she's going to refuse. Maybe I won't have to stay here after all. Then the front door creaks open. We turn to see a tall, thin, dark-haired man wearing a plaid shirt with rolled-up sleeves and grungy overalls.
The girl will go to school, whether she wants to or not,
he says.
I'll make sure of it.
Mr. Sorensen strides over and extends his hand.
You must be Gerald Grote. I'm Chester Sorensen, and this is Dorothy.
Nice to meet you.
Mr. Grote clasps his hand, nods over toward me.
She'll do just fine.
All right, then,
Mr. Sorensen says, clearly relieved.
Let's make it official.
There's paperwork, but not a lot. It's only a few minutes before Mr. Sorensen has retrieved my bag from the truck and is driving away. I watch him through the cracked front window with the baby, Nettie, whimpering on my hip. Hemingford County, Minnesota, 1930. Where will I sleep? I ask Mr. Grote when it gets dark. He looks at me, hands on his hips, as if he hasn't considered this question. He gestures toward the hallway.
There's a bedroom yonder,
he says.
If you don't want to sleep with the others, I guess you can sleep out here on the couch. We don't stand on ceremony. I've been known to doze off on it myself.
In the bedroom, 3 old mattresses without sheets are laid across the floor, a carpet of bony springs. Mabel, Gerald Jr., and Harold sprawl across them, tugging a tattered wool blanket and 3 old quilts from each other. I don't want to sleep here, but it's better than sharing the couch with Mr. Grote. In the middle of the night, one kid or another ends up under the crook of my arm or spooned against my back. They smell earthy and sour, like wild animals. Despair inhabits this house. Mrs. Grote doesn't want all these kids, and neither she nor Mr. Grote really takes care of them. She sleeps all the time, and the children come and go from her bed. There's brown paper tacked over the open window in that room, so it's as dark as a hole in the ground. The children burrow in next to her, craving warmth. Sometimes she lets them crawl in, and sometimes she pushes them out. When they're denied a spot, their wails penetrate my skin like tiny needles. There's no running water, and no electricity or indoor plumbing here. The groats use gas lights and candles, and there's a pump and an outhouse in the backyard, wood stacked on the porch. The damp logs in the fireplace make the house smoky and give off a tepid heat. Mrs. Groat barely looks at me. She sends a child out to be fed, or calls me to fix her a cup of coffee. She makes me nervous. I do what I'm told, and make an effort to avoid her. The children sniff around, trying to get used to me, all except for 2-year-old Gerald Jr., who takes to me right away, follows me like a puppy. I ask Mr. Groat how they found me. He says he saw a flyer in town, homeless children for distribution. Wilma wouldn't get out of bed, and he didn't know what else to do. I feel abandoned and forgotten, dropped into misery worse than my own. Mr. Groat says he'll never get another job if he can manage it. He plans to live off the land. He was born and raised in the woods. It's the only life he knows or cares to know. He built this house with his own 2 hands, he says, and his goal is to be entirely self-sufficient. He has an old goat in the backyard and a mule and 6 chickens. He can feed his family on what he can hunt and find in the woods and on a handful of seeds, along with the goat's milk and eggs from the chickens, and he can sell things in town if he has to. Mr. Groat is lean and fit from walking miles every day. Like an Indian, he says. He has a car, but it's rusted and broken down behind the house. He can't afford to get it fixed, so he goes everywhere on foot or sometimes on the old mule that he says wandered off from a horse meat truck that broke down on the road a few months back. His fingernails are rimmed with grime, made up of axle grease and planting soil and animal blood and who knows what else, ground in so deep it can't be washed off. I've only ever seen him in 1 pair of overalls. Mr. Groat doesn't believe in government telling him what to do. Tell the truth, he doesn't believe in government at all. He has never been to school a day in his life, and doesn't see the point. But he'll send me to school, if that's what it takes to keep the authorities out of his hair. On Monday, 3 days after I arrive, Mr. Groat shakes my shoulder in the darkness so I can get ready for school. The room is so cold I can see my breath. I put on one of my new dresses with both sweaters layered on top. I wear Fanny's mittens, the thick stockings I wore from New York, my sturdy black shoes. I run out to the pump and fill a pitcher with cold water, then bring it inside to heat on the stove. After pouring warm water in a tin bowl, I take a rag and scrub my face, my neck, my fingernails. There's an old mirror in the kitchen, spotted with rusty stains and freckled with black specks, so ruined it's almost impossible to see myself in. I divide my unwashed hair into 2 pigtails, using my fingers as a comb, and then braid them tightly, tying the ends with thread from the packet Fanny made for me. Then I look closely at my reflection. I am as clean as I can manage without taking a bath. My face is pale and serious. I barely have any breakfast, just some wild rice pudding made with goat's milk and maple syrup Mr. Groat tapped the day before. I am so relieved to be getting out of this dark, fetid cabin for the day that I swing Harold around, joke with Gerald Jr., share my rice pudding with Mabel, who has only just started looking me in the eye. Mr. Groat draws a map for me with a knife in the dirt. You go out the drive, turn left there where you came in, walk till you get to the T-section, then go over that bridge back yonder and on till you get to the county road. 30 minutes, give or take. He doesn't offer a lunch pail, and I don't ask for one. I slip the 2 eggs I boiled the night before when I was making supper into my coat pocket. I have that piece of paper from Mr. Sorensen that says a man named Mr. Post, who drives the kids to school in his truck, will be at the corner at 8:30 a.m. and bring me back at 4:30 p.m. It's 7:40, but I'm ready to go. Better to wait at the corner than risk missing my ride. I skip down the driveway, hurry up the road, linger on the bridge for a moment, looking down at the reflection of the sky like mercury on the dark water, the foaming white suds near the rocks. Ice glistens on tree branches, frost webs over dried grasses in a sparkling net. The evergreens are dusted with the light snow that fell last night like a forest of Christmas trees. For the first time, I am struck by the beauty of this place. I hear the truck before I see it.
About 20 yards from me, it slows to a stop with a great screeching of brakes, and I have to run back along the road to get on. An apple-faced man in a tan cap peers out at me.
Come on, darling. Don't have all day.
The truck has a tarpaulin over its bed. I climb in the back, laid with two flat planks for passengers to sit on. There's a heap of horse blankets in the corner, and the four kids sitting there are huddled in them, having wrapped the blankets over their shoulders and tucked them around their legs. The canvas cover gives everyone a yellowish tint. Two of the kids appear close to my age. As we bump along, I hang on to the wooden bench with my mittened fingers so I don't fall onto the floor when we hit a rough patch. The driver stops twice more to pick up passengers. The bed is only big enough to seat six comfortably, and eight of us are crammed in here. We're tight on the bench, but our bodies give off much-needed warmth. Nobody speaks. When the truck is moving, wind slices through the gaps in the tarp. After several miles, the truck makes a turn, brakes squealing, and climbs up a steep driveway before grinding to a stop. We jump out of the truck bed and line up, then walk to the schoolhouse, a small clapboard building with a bell in front. A young woman, in a cornflower blue dress, a lavender scarf wrapped around her neck, is standing at the front door. Her face is pretty and lively, big brown eyes and a wide smile. Her shiny brown hair is pulled back with a white ribbon. Welcome, children. Proceed in an orderly fashion, as always. Her voice is high and clear. Good morning, Michael, Bertha, Darlene, she says, greeting each child by name. When I reach her, she says, Now, I haven't met you yet, but I heard you were coming. I'm Miss Larson, and you must be... I say, Neve, at the same time that she says, Dorothy. Seeing the expression on my face, she says, Did I get that wrong? Or do you have a nickname? No, ma'am. It's just, I feel my cheeks redden. What is it? I used to be Neve. Sometimes I forget what my name is. Nobody really calls me anything at my new home. Well, I can call you Neve, if you like. It's all right. Dorothy is fine. She smiles, studying my face. As you wish. Lucy Green, she says, turning to the girl behind me. Would you mind showing Dorothy to her desk? I follow Lucy into an area lined with hooks, where we hang up our coats. Then we enter a large, sunny room smelling of wood smoke and chalk that contains an oil stove, a desk for the teacher, rows of benches and workspaces, and slate blackboards along the east and south walls, with posters of the alphabet and multiplication tables above. The other walls are made up of large windows. Electric lights shine overhead, and low shelves are filled with books. When everyone is seated, Miss Larson pulls a loop on a string, and a colorful map of the world unfurls on the wall. At her request, I go up to the map and identify Ireland. Looking at it closely, I can find County Galway, and even the city center. The village of Kinvara isn't named, but I rub the place where it belongs, right under Galway on the jagged line of the west coast. There is New York, and here's Chicago, and here's Minneapolis. Hemingford County isn't on the map either. Including me, there are 23 of us between the ages of 6 and 16. Most of the other kids are from farms themselves and other rural homes and are learning to read and write at all ages. We smell unwashed, and it's worse with the older ones who have hit puberty. There's a heap of rags, a few bars of soap, and a carton of baking soda in the indoor lavatory, Miss Larson tells me, in case you want to freshen up. When Miss Larson talks to me, she bends down and looks me in the eye. When she asks questions, she waits for my answer. She smells of lemons and vanilla, and she treats me like I'm smart. After I take a test to determine my reading level, she hands me a book from the shelf by her desk, a hardcover filled with small black type called Anne of Green Gables, without pictures, and tells me she will ask what I think of it when I'm done. You'd think with all these kids it would be chaotic, but Miss Larson rarely raises her voice. The driver, Mr. Post, chops wood, tends the stove, sweeps the leaves from the front walkway, and does mechanical repairs on the truck. He also teaches mathematics up to geometry, which he says he never learned because that year was locusts and he was needed on the farm. At recess, Lucy invites me to play games with a group of them. Annie Annie over, pump pump pull away, ring around the rosy. When I get out of the truck at 4:30 and have to walk the long route back to the cabin, my footsteps are slow. The food this family subsists on is like nothing I've ever eaten before. Mr. Groat leaves at dawn with his rifle and rod and brings home squirrels and wild turkeys, whiskery fish, now and then a white-tailed deer. He returns in the late afternoon covered in pine tree gum. He brings home red squirrels most of all, but they aren't as good as the larger fox and gray squirrels, which he calls bushy tails. The fox squirrels are so big that some of them look like orange cats. They chirp and whistle, and he tricks them into showing themselves by clicking two coins together, which sounds like their chatter. The gray squirrels have the most meat, he tells me, but are hardest to see in the woods. They make a harsh ch-ch noise when they're angry or scared. That's how he finds them. Mr. Groat skins and guts the animals in several fluid motions, then hands me tiny hearts and livers, slabs of deep red meat. All I know how to make is boiled cabbage and mutton, I